Welcome to the podcast series Creating Life for Future Based. I am Marjolein Pijnappels, multidisciplinary researcher and creator. In these podcasts, you will listen in on my interviews with scientists and artists about topics as diverse as human birth, plant-fungal interactions, and the pan microbiome. These interviews are open-ended, exploratory dialogues and part of my research effort to figure out what it means to create life and be alive and what defines a human being in all that. For more information, check futurebased.org. Today I'm talking to Professor Elslyn Kingma of King's College London, where she holds the Peter Sowerby Chair in Philosophy and Medicine. Welcome, Elslyn.
Hello, nice to be here.
I'm really looking forward to our conversation today because you have invested a large part of your work into research of the metaphysics of pregnancy. And I was so interested in theory about parthood, about how you can look at mammalian embryos like we are mammals, and how they might be considered, you know, a part of the organism that gestates it, the mother. Elslyn, could you maybe introduce the work you are currently working on? Because I'm so interested in your work relating the metaphysics of pregnancy.
Yes, thank you. Well, let me first explain what the metaphysics of pregnancy is, because maybe not everybody would know or can be expected to know.
Yeah, good idea.
Metaphysics is the branch of philosophy that is concerned with what there is in the world, as opposed to, for example, in ethics, how the world should be. So metaphysics concerns questions like, what are we? What is time? And what is causation? And numerous other questions. And so the metaphysics of pregnancy really asks, well, what is this unique state of pregnancy? What are its characteristics? How should we think about it? And that's not a question, perhaps surprisingly, that I think has really been asked very well. Of course, people have thought about embryos and fetuses a lot, particularly in the context of, for example, abortion or other questions, ethical questions about reproduction. But I tend to think of fetuses and embryos as kind of in isolation. And of course, that's where the metaphysics of pregnancy comes in, because that is precisely how embryos and particularly fetuses do not occur. They do not occur in isolation. They only occur in the context of a pregnancy. And so my research looks at pregnancy and asks, well, what is this unique state? And particularly, what is the relationship between the maternal organism or the maternal mammal and the fetus that resides within it?
Yeah, and it's a subject that's, like you said, not studied a lot from that point of view. And I think that's also to do with the fact that philosophers historically and traditionally were men, and maybe it's a topic that wasn't very much on the top of their mind, and that it's now maybe a topic that's being studied more, but it's still not explored very broadly.
I mean, it's gaining traction, so I think my work has gotten attention. You know, it seems like more people are starting to work on it. I think it's true that's been overlooked. Of course, I mean, this is guesswork, but I share your inclination to think that maybe it historically has something to do with philosophy being dominated by men. I mean, also by men who are maybe quite removed historically from the domestic sphere. But, you know, I told this theory to a friend and she said, no, it's just too difficult. So, I mean, who knows?
Maybe
who
knows? It's complex. It's biologically complex, but also, you know, on all these, it's very an emotional topic as well. And you mentioned the case of abortion, and that's a very touchy topic. And that's why I thought your theory was so, or your theory, the model that you've been working on, is so interesting. And maybe you could explain a little bit more about, you know, the parthood model and about how it's different from the way we tend to think about pregnancy and embryos and, you know, babies growing inside of the mother traditionally.
So yes, let me tell you something about the parthood view and the content of my research. So as I said, I think this question about the nature of pregnancy and the relationship between the fetus and the maternal organism has been overlooked. But I think insofar as people tend to have a view on it, there's a kind of implicit view that we have and picture that we're being fed, where the fetus is a separate individual that is merely contained within the maternal organism. Find this imagery all over the place. I mean, the early imagery of fetuses in the 70s, these were, of course, aborted fetuses, but they were kind of presented as if they were real and alive, were kind of presented in isolation. And you often see this picture of the disembodied fetus. I mean, it's not disembodied from its own body, but it's disembodied from the maternal body, kind of floating into space like an astronaut. And I mean, you find this imagery all over the place. I think often the way that pregnant women are taught to think about their fetus is also kind of strangely disembodied. So there's a sense of, if I drink this alcohol, or if I drink this, smoke this cigarette, or do this or this, that will affect the fetus. But there's no sense that everything affects your fetus, right? So, I mean, if you're stressed or if you're anxious about these things, that anything you do affects the fetus because it's part of you, right? And so there's a sense of like, I must play music to the fetus,
yeah,
not realizing that, of course, if you listen to the radio, the fetus listens to the radio. It listens to your voice all day. So we kind of detach, and I think in our imagery, the fetus from the pregnant woman and treat it as a separate entity that just happens to reside within. And that's what I call the containment view of pregnancy. And so against that, I've just kind of thought, well, if you think just a little bit more carefully about the physiology, about what is and isn't part of an organism, it seems much more plausible that we should think of the fetus as a part of the maternal organism, right? It's integrated in her physiology. This is one metabolic system, right? This is one organism with one waste disposal system, one source of breathing and food, one immune system that tolerates the fetus. So this is one organism that is growing apart, which is the embryo and then the fetus, and then, of course, expels that part at birth, and then it becomes an organism in its own right. So that's the partial view of pregnancy.
I have two pregnancies and births, and I'm not sure if you make conclusions based on personal experience, but when I heard about your parenthood model, I thought this sort of is much closer to the way I experienced pregnancy, as growing these little parts of myself that then were born. And also after they were born, they still felt very much a part of me. Is that something you get back from people, that they recognize that and find this model closer to their personal experience? Or do people find this difficult to accept?
You know, I haven't done a systematic survey on this. So all of this, of course, is anecdotal. I think to an extent, yes, from women who've been pregnant. So early on, when I was very nervous about this work, I would kind of come up against, I guess, predominantly men who would be like, oh, but surely intuitively the fetus isn't a part. And I would kind of think, well, you know, according to whose intuitions and what are those intuitions based on? I was prepared for women like yourself who've been pregnant to say, you know, this strikes me as really intuitive when it comes to pregnancy and my own pregnancy. But what I wasn't prepared for, and so it's really interesting to me that you too bring this up, is that lots of women says, but why does it cease to be a part at birth? Because after birth, it still feels like a part. And then only later on, it kind of, just as you said, right, it slowly becomes kind of less and less of a part. And so that was quite striking. I hadn't expected that. And also I'm still not sure what to do with it, because although it's nice that what I say are kind of accords with at least certain ways in which people intuitively seem to construe pregnancy, of course, my arguments aren't based on the way people think and experience their own pregnancy. And certainly the kind of arguments I give, you know, birth does come up as kind of a watershed moment. Although you could say something about breastfeeding and still being one metabolic system, but at least there are women who've been pregnant who find this view intuitive. I find that encouraging. I also do find that once you start paying attention, this language of, right, it's a part of me, crops up in various places by women, in writing by women. Yeah. Of course, what makes that really surprising is that, you know, there's this dominance of the fetal container view has just been able to be there relatively unchallenged. Although we should also pay attention to the fact, you know, here we are, I presume, I don't know, of course, but, you know, I presume your pregnancies were wanted, they went well. You know, women have lots and lots of different pregnancies for different reasons, with different outcomes and with different degrees of desirability. And, you know, people may well feel very different about a pregnancy that isn't desired.
Of course, I think that makes all the difference. And there's, you know, so many people as there are in the world, as many experiences there are.
Yes.
What I find striking about what you're saying is you said you talked about the language around birth and also about how if we grow something, someone that's a part of us, and we can agree that at one point in time, they are an individual and we are not sharing any systems, metabolic or otherwise, with each other anymore. We don't have a language for this sort of, I'm calling this dual entity, pregnant mother or the nursing mother. We don't have any way to think about that. I lack the language to explain even to myself or to others how this actually works. Like if something is a part of someone else, and at one point it becomes its own individual, what happens in between?
Yes. No, I mean, it's an excellent question, right? I mean, on the one hand, I kind of think that's why maybe the fetal containment model view has been so attractive, because it doesn't mean that we have to deal with this messiness of one becoming two, right? And like, how does that happen? And what happens in, you know, if that's not like instantaneous, then we have this messy, like, what is it? 1 1/4, 1 1/2, something in between. Yeah, that's messy. We don't like messiness. So maybe that's one of the attractions of the containment view, that you can say, oh no, it's always two, just one within the other. And then all we have to figure out is when the additional one comes into existence. And in a way, I guess I have also shirked away from the messiness, because of course, if birth is a fairly momentous and a monumentous thing, right? I mean, it's about us sudden in biology where everything is gradual, you know, birth is about as much of a disconnect, right? A sudden thing of change as you can get.
Yeah, and so in a way, level, right? I mean, babies, they have to breathe, they have to start using their lungs, their navels,
the medical cord,
and yeah, it's all severed and it stops, and they sort of become sort of different organisms, almost, at least. Yes. They have different functions, and then it's a logical point to say, okay, this is also where, you know, the new individual starts.
I mean, it's true. I think birth, and we often underestimate this, it is a very substantial change. You know, it's not quite like a metamorphosis, like a larvae turning into a butterfly, but it, you know, lots has to change and has to change in very particular ways. It's a massive physiological transition. So if you kind of take that to be the point where one becomes two, you kind of still get away from the messiness. But I think you point out quite rightly that maybe that is still too easy a solution. Maybe we do have to deal with this, you know, this way in which the female organism grows this new entity, and there's this gradual detachment, and it's a little bit unclear. There's a lot more work there to be done, and I think you pinpoint a very good question. I mean, it's a question I still would like to say more about, think more about as well, also because I think from it may well follow some views about the kind of political and ethical entitlements of mothers and parents and families and children that we're not particularly good at recognizing. So, you know, you described that you don't, I mean, people often talk of the maternal baby diet, I think in midwifery, for example, mm-hmm. you know, where they try, and I think also in anthropology, where they kind of do recognize that, you know, there's a mother and there's a baby, but also the mother and the baby form a kind of relevant unit that needs to be recognized for certain purposes.
But yeah, because there's so, on this topic, there's so many directions, because it's unexplored land to large parts, so many directions you could take. And I think I really agree that part of the interesting things is that in the current societies, at least, I mean, I don't know many societies, I know our Dutch society, I think most Western societies, they view mother and baby as two entities with often opposite needs and wants, and try to balance that, or at least, whereas what would we advise pregnant people if we sort of looked at the mother baby as one unit, and how would our care system look like? I think those are very interesting questions. And I'm also interested to what it does to our own sense of self, because we're so used to thinking of ourselves as individuals. That's actually one of the cornerstones, I think, of our society, Western society at least, that we are individuals, and we find trouble thinking of ourselves as a part of someone else, even if it was at a time that we couldn't even remember it, and think of our children children or infants or in the belly as parts of ourselves. I think that's something really challenging for our own sense of identity as human beings. Is that something you recognize or have thought about?
Yes, but it's not something I have figured out yet. I mean, let me say two things. So one is something you talked about a little bit earlier, right, where you said we often tend to posit the fetus and the mother as kind of opposite or in conflict. So the tricky thing is, so I think that's, to an extent, I think that's true, but there's always a kind of a back and forth between a view of pregnancy as, you know, oppositional, where the mother and the fetus are in conflict. And I think that can be really damaging. But then the counterpoint is often to kind of posit pregnancies like complete harmony. And I think that is also problematic, because it is true that mothers and fetuses or mothers and babies can have divergent interests. And so I think, so what we need to do here, what we need to develop, is a view of pregnancy that just can recognize both things, right? So that it can recognize the intertwinement and an interdependence, and the very particular needs that pregnant women, but also mothers of new babies, nursing mothers of new babies, and their babies have, right? So need for support with breastfeeding, not to be separated. I mean, all sorts of very important, very basic needs, so that we recognize that intertwinement and also the way in which their welfare is bound up with each other, but also recognize that, yes, they can have divergent interests, right? So we need to have a model that can deal with both of that, rather than falling in one extreme or the other.
Yeah.
So that was one thing I wanted to say. And I think that is difficult, but maybe something like Parenthood will help. And the other question, yeah, was about individuality. So I think, Lynn, I agree that us being individuals is kind of a cornerstone of a lot of our thinking, where we think about ourselves, but also often how our ethics and our law is set up. I mean, in philosophy, there's long been a kind of feminist branch of criticism of this view that we somehow emerge. I always think of Athena here emerging from Zeus's head in like fully clad in armor, right? That we emerge as fully formed adult individuals with freedom and autonomy and a capacity to think. And we're brought to that point by being first made by a female mammal, right? By a mother, by a woman in the body of a woman. And then we need to be nurtured for like 20 years or so, yeah, by, you know, a whole bunch of people. And it's that that creates and scaffolds and produces those kind of prized possessions of, you know, capacity for reason and freedom and individuality. I also agree with you. It is challenging to think of yourself as having once been part of somebody else. And I think it is challenging to think of what pregnancy does. So I think it's right. There are all these things there that we grapple with. And I haven't got answers to all of them, but it's important to put them on the table and think about.
I think philosophers always ask more questions than they can answer. At least that's something
that
I
is
heard.
Our job. Yes.
That is your job.
That's what we like to think. Clarity in questions, I think, is important.
One thing I was also curious to your thoughts on is we touched on the abortion debate and how sometimes that is a place where people are really divided on the rights of the fetus versus the rights of the mother. What's always baffling to me at some point, I'm a biologist. I'm used to looking and thinking at organisms in all stages of life, all different species. And it's always sort of amazed me a little bit that pro-life, people that call themselves pro-life, that they are so protective of even sometimes fertilized eggs that are only maybe a couple of weeks old. And we have these other, you know, living cells, sperm, egg cells, that are sort of the precursor to these fertilized eggs, but they are not valued at all, which seems logical. To me, it's sometimes strange to see that people hold such importance to one, you know, stage or one entity and not to the other. And I heard you talk, or read something about you talking about, you know, what are the entities that persist throughout conception and pregnancy? I think that's one of the things that you studied with the research grant you got from the European Research Council for the better understanding the metaphysics of pregnancy. And I was just curious to hear your thoughts on that, like all these different stages, developmental stages, and we have such different feelings and emotions attached to it. Is there a metaphysical basis for that as well?
Yes. I mean, good question. Difficult one to answer. So privately, I share some of your bafflement. I mean, I find it really difficult to attach the kind of import to very early stages of human reproduction. You know, I mean, in part, just knowing how wasteful biology is, right? I mean, it's a matter of coincidence that we're like humans rather than like, I think it's the Tasmanian devil that produces like 40 embryos and, you know, they have a race and the first 4 or 8 or 6 make it to the teats and the rest get eaten. You know, I mean, they weren't fast enough. And we kind of do this at the sperm stage rather than at the embryo stage. Although, of course, we still have high rates of miscarriage and most miscarriage is just the body's way of selecting what, you know, because a pregnancy is a big investment. You want to make a good investment as a female mammal. And I too share some of your bafflement of the import that people want to attach to these very early stages. Right. But, you know, but that is my view. And there are clearly people who have very different views about it, often religiously motivated. But then also I think that is difficult to argue with, because if you just think that conception transforms this magic importance that it confers a soul, right? An eternal soul. I mean, that's not something that I believe, and also not something that I can therefore argue with. Although you also have philosophers who make these arguments on the grounds of persistence, right? So they may not have sort of background religious views, but they just say, look, I am a human. I came from a baby. The baby came from a fetus. The fetus came from an embryo. The embryo came from a zygote. And so there is persistence. And so whatever, you know, given that we value all human life, we should value the zygote. But I should also say, I think if you go as far back as the zygote,
why not go further?
Exactly. Why not go back to the egg, right? Because there is this myth that conception is a fusion of two cells. But of course, that's just not true. There's an egg, and the egg is made by the female organism, and there's just a cell, which is the egg. And at the point of conception, you know, the egg picks up a little packet of DNA from the sperm, and it discards a little packet of DNA, and it's just one step in the process of development. So I mean, yeah, if you go back as far as the zygote, which some philosophers do, I think there are very good reasons for going far as back as the egg. And then, of course, you know, I existed pretty much all through my mother's life.
Is there one thing when you look at what you've done that you find especially enlightening about this topic? What's the thing that fascinates you personally the most that got you into this research maybe and is something that you want to learn and understand more and more and more of?
Well, I think what got me into this research, and in a way, you know, I just kind of maybe worth mentioning, I kind of thought of this topic, you know, before pregnancy. I mean, I have now been pregnant. I have got kids. But before pregnancy was on the horizon for me, I just sort of had this bafflement that it seemed to me like potentially the obvious way to think of pregnancy was in terms of parenthood. And I was just sort of baffled that nobody seemed to share this view. And so that kind of bafflement mixed with some bafflement about a more general, like absurd ways in which pregnancies get discussed in the literature, right? So as we just discussed, this sort of complete absence of the mother frequently, of the maternal mammal. I thought maybe if you become pregnant, it's just really obvious that it's the containment view. And that's why, you know, so maybe if I become pregnant, I would just be cured of this view, of this bafflement. And I mean, I did become pregnant at some point. And it kind of reaffirmed me in my bafflement, because I was like, no, it's not at all obviously containment. So I think that got me into it. But then it just sort of spread like a kind of an oil spill, because, you know, everything I touch, I'm like, there's more questions. You know, we touched upon some of these, like the questions about the weird ways in which we construe, you know, the way women think about their babies and what does and doesn't affect them. And then, yeah, what do we do about breastfeeding and the mother-baby diet and these kind of conflicts, opposites that are often posited. And then there's the pressure on pregnant women. And, you know, I'm really bothered, for example, by whenever I read of mothers and babies being separated, right? I tend to think, do we really sufficiently recognize what kind of damage this is. And this is something I'd kind of like to think about it, right? So none of us think anymore that it's okay to take people's hands or ears as a punishment, right? We just don't do that. It doesn't matter really what the crime or the perceived benefit of it is. We kind of rest in a kind of an absolute bodily autonomy, which means we don't do corporal punishment. But we do separate mothers and babies. And I sometimes think, is that, you know, where we think it's in the best interest of the baby? And I sometimes think, have we thought of the nature of the damage, of what kind of an infringement that is? You know, there's sometimes weighty interests at stake because not all mothers manage to adequately care for their children.
These are big dilemmas.
I want to think about more. Lots of things. Works to be written, but you know, sometimes you're right.
You have so much more work to do, Elsa, because I think that for us as a society to rethink the way we think about birth and also of us as a human species, I think that ultimately this also sheds a new light and new insights on how we, you know, relate to one another. And I think that a lot of these things that we've discussed, they play out in a much broader context. And a lot of people are affected by the way we look at birth, even if they don't have babies themselves, but we don't see that anymore.
Yes, I think I broadly agree with that. I mean, there are lots of things that have been said before that don't come squarely out of my research, but they are kind of reaffirmed by them. And I think one is that, we just tend to overlook and disvalue the efforts involved in making and raising children, mm-hmm. which is, of course, the effort that thank heavens, isn't all done by women mm-hmm. anymore, especially the nurturing part. You know, it's increasingly shared, but historically it's been done by women. Mm-hmm. And then the making part is largely women. You know, we tend to forget that, like, for anything to happen, you know, to have those autonomous free individuals, you know, to have mm-hmm. leaders, scientists, prime ministers, workers, an economy, anything, we need to bring babies
into the world and raise them,
right? Yeah. And that is a huge job, and it's always overlooked. And people frequently say ridiculous things. They say, oh, if we have artificial wombs, then we could just go and people could produce armies. And I'm always like, well, but how? What are you gonna do with an army of babies?
I think that it also overlooks like the real physical interactions between mother and baby, and tend to overlook the big impact the way we look at birth and pregnancy and deal with that has on the health of all the people, all the future people and current people as well. Like the way we have increased numbers of cesareans and the way that affects the microbiome of the baby when it's born vaginally, it gets seeded by all these healthy microbes from the mothers through passing through the birth canal, which are lacking with a cesarean birth, for example, and also separating mother and baby after pregnancy instead of having skin-to-skin contact also impacts the health of the baby and the person it'll grow into because of these sharing or not sharing of microbes. And I think those are all, you know, different branches, but all come down to not magically solved by looking at the mother and baby as one entity, but it will certainly rethink those kinds of things too and have a huge impact on health of our whole, you know, world population in the future.
Yes, I mean, talking about, you know, birth and birth medicalization is sort of a whole separate topic almost, but it's a tricky one, right? Because I think that on the one hand, there is increasing recognition, all sorts of things, right, of the enormous impact that, you know, that because of this unique intertwined gestational relationship, pregnant women have huge impact on their fetuses, right? Everything, and their fetuses, their future children, aka the world population, everything they do, right, affects the fetus. What that often means is that it just results in huge amounts of pressure on pregnant women. I mean, I think you find that too with the example you gave of the cesareans. So, you know, people have pointed to the boards, the microbiome and things like that to try and counter, you know, give an argument why at an institutional level, very high cesarean section rates are maybe not a good idea. But then a lot of the effect is that, you know, individual mothers feel it is upon them to make sure they don't have a cesarean section. Yes. And then they feel guilty when they've had one. And that's like a micro example of how a lot of motherhood plays out. So
yeah, it's sort of like the responsibility of the individual mother to have, like, what is a good birth anyway, but to have a good birth. And what I think I'm trying to
No, that's not what you're trying to say, but it's, I think it's a very important thing to highlight in this context. So for almost everything, right, come to nutrition or things like that, the way we've kind of construed our thinking about motherhood and our individualistic nature is that almost immediately always gets translated towards to as the individual responsibility mm-hmm. of the mother at hand.
But it should be a societal responsibility.
As a wider social institutional responsibility.
Sure.
So that is one main problem. And the other kind of thing that is problematic there is that we work with this model where, and this again is where the disembodied fetus come in, right? That the fetus would be perfect if it weren't for the mother's drinking, smoking, bad eating, cesarean birth, or, you know, you name it, lack of breastfeeding, you know, failure to source organic food, pick any example you want. Whereas, of course, there is no perfect fetus that would be if it weren't for the mother doing all these things, right? The fetus is only there and is only being made good because the mother breathes and births and eats and does all these things. So there's this tendency to only think of what women do that falls short of perfection rather than all the things they do to contribute, right, to the growing. And I think so it's really tricky because I think in this toxic cultural mix surrounding motherhood where, you know, almost everything you say in this domain gets wielded as, you know, another whip to whip mothers with. I mean, that's another thing that I kind of constantly run up against and that baffles me, but that I think is quite clear cultural phenomena. And I mean, that's a real problem because it also means that almost anything important or positive that comes out of any of this kind of research will be used to kind of negative ends, right? So
that's really true. Yeah,
sketches into the kind of culture of motherhood. But that's, I think, a really concerning phenomenon that almost just seems to get worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, I agree. That's what I see a lot and what I experienced myself as well. And I think that's not something we unfortunately are going to, you know, fix in this conversation or on the short term, I think.
No, but it's an important one to, I think, it's a very important one to be, I think, aware of in the background.
It's not just, you know, the metaphysical way of looking at it. There's also with this topic, a lot of emotions involved. And I think in this podcast, which is, you know, about creating life by humans, it's obviously logical that some of these topics arise and that they spark more emotions than when in one of my previous conversations, I talked about fungi and how fungi, you know, procreates. That's such a different way to look at it. And still, I'm interested in trying to sort of, well, not detach it from the emotions, but also look at it from a physical point of view and showing people there are different ways of looking at pregnancy and mothers and motherhood. Well, for me, obviously hoping and trying to sort of get people thinking on these kinds of topics and changing the way we relate to one another, how we look at mothers and how we care for each other in society, which is sort of a lofty goal.
No, I agree, right? So I share that interest in thinking about the biology as well. You know, we are mammals. There are things that we share with dolphins and elephant seals and cows and, you know, every other mammal. And I think that is a worthwhile perception. So I think it's important to talk about the taboo about miscarriage and that's a problem. But I think it's also worth talking about the biology of miscarriage and recognizing this, not as a biological failure, which is often how it's felt by women, but actually it's just biological functionality.
Yeah.
Right. This is just like, this is how things and all that, like, are we going to prevent all those miscarriages?
We can.
It's crap.
It's part
right?
of it's we part can't. Of life.
So that's why I often talk about the mammals and attempt to, although I'm well aware of the important emotions in the background, philosophy precisely is the place where you should also make sure, make space for saying, well, let's just approach this from a perspective that mice would also share. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot to be gained in it, but I think it's important to recognize that's not the only perspective and to recognize how some of those things can then be taken up and misconstrued or be toxified in our cultural context. It's a tricky area to work in.
Yeah, it's always, it's hooray for the multiple perspectives always, I think, in these kinds of topics.
There's maybe one thing I just want to make clear. So we've talked about the parted view and people often mistake what I say for something like the view that if the fetus is a part of the maternal organism, people draw all sorts of implications for that. Therefore, it's not an individual, or therefore it's not valuable, or therefore it's just like a kidney, or therefore you could do anything you want with it. And that, of course, doesn't follow, right? I mean, from the view that the fetus is a part of the maternal organism, that can still be a part that is unlike other parts, right? I think obviously it's unlike other parts. I think obviously it's got a kind of a value that your eyebrows don't have, just as kidneys and eyebrows are already very different. And so I just wanted to make that clear. And also it seems that it's potentially possible to think that it is an organism already in its own right and also part of another organism. That's a further question. Yeah. So I just wanted to make that clear, because people often jump to conclusions that I think just aren't warranted by the claims.
I think that's so, actually, that's such an interesting note to end our conversation on, because you basically say, you know, we call it a part, doesn't say anything about its you know, worthfulness to anyone, or about if it's not valuable in its own right, it can be a part and an individual organism at the same time. Yes. I think this boils down to, we don't have the language for it. So we borrow, like containment is something that's borrowed, just like part is something that's borrowed, but it's actually either all of these things maybe, or none of these things. And in waiting for a new language to describe these entities, maybe we just have to make do with the language that we have, which is always imperfect, but comes really close.
Yeah, and I think what we need to be open to, and I think that's maybe the main thing I want people to think about is, you know, we need to be able to accommodate pregnancy. Pregnancy is not weird or liminal or unusual. It's how every human comes to be. So if our notions struggle to cope with it, we need to adjust our theory, right? So if people kind of say, oh, you can't be a part and an organism, then I'm inclined to think, well, if that's what pregnancy seems to be, then it is possible to be a part and an organism. And we just got to adjust our notions in light of this, because pregnancy is just a central human condition, as, you know, being an adult male or an 8-year-old child, or this is kind of core to how we come to be, and we've got to be able to accommodate it.
Very well said. I think we've come to the end of our conversation now. I think we could have talked for hours. I would really like to thank you for your contribution.
My pleasure. It was really nice to chat about it.
For more information, links and show notes, please visit futurebased.org.